This song has a history in Kansas City. Have you ever heard it before?
I would work for you. I'd slave for you. I'd be a beggar or a knave for you. If that ain't love, it'll have to do. Until the real thing comes along, I'd gladly move the earth for you. To prove my love, dear, and its worth for you. If that ain't love, it'll have to do. Until the real thing comes along.
This is called Until the Real Thing Comes Along, and I found out about it while researching an old Kansas City group called the Three Chocolate Drops. Everything I could turn up was about this song. In fact, our own Chuck Haddix, host of The Fish Fry on KCUR, called it a Kansas City standard. That phrase caught my attention. I knew we had our own bands, even our own sound, but I didn't know that we had our own songs that everyone would have to riff on, but just here, just in Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman, and for today's show on KCUR's Central Standard, we've invited Chuck Haddix to tell us about the Kansas City standards that some of us, maybe even most of us, have forgotten. Hi, Chuck.
Well, hello, Gina. Good to be here with you this morning.
Thanks for joining me. What is the story behind this song, Until the Real Thing Comes Along?
Well, it's a real interesting story. Originally, it was part of a stage review called Rhapsody in Black. It was written for that. It was called Till the Real Thing Comes Along. And Ethel Waters performed it as part of that review. And she came to Kansas City in 1933 with the review and performed it at the Schubert Theater. And the Three Chocolate Drops, including Jimmy McFadden, known as Smiley Jimmy McFadden, who was
the father of the McFadden brothers who still perform.
That is correct. And he was a very popular local MC and also a dancer, a very well-known figure. And they picked up on it, but they couldn't quite remember the lyrics, so they improvised a variation on it, and it became Until the Real Thing Comes Along. And it was also known as the slave song.
Yeah, I'd work for you, I'd slave for you. Those are the first lyrics, which are fairly startling first lyrics.
Yeah, and it's an instance where a pop standard is adopted by Kansas City artists, and then it becomes a Kansas City song, a standard. And it was performed in the cabarets and the Playmore and the other ballrooms here in Kansas City by a number of different groups. And then it was copyrighted by a guy named Slim Freeman, who was a tenor saxophonist. And then in the spring of 1936, Andy Kirk recorded for the Decca label. And it went to the West Coast and recorded. And he wanted to record this song, and Jap Cap, the producer, wanted to record nothing but swing and novelty numbers. And finally, he let the band record Until the Real Thing Comes Along. The big hit they were promoting was Christopher Columbus. And that late spring, early summer, the song was released Until the Real Thing Comes Along, and it hit nationally. And Andy Kirk was playing that summer at Fairland Park. And so he performed
that. The amusement
park. Yeah, the amusement
park. That is no longer.
Yeah. See, the bands in Kansas City would play a summer-long gig at the Fairland Park. And they had a big dance pavilion there. So here's Andy Kirk. He's obligated to play Fairland Park, and he's got a national hit, which established him nationally, the band nationally. That's what the Kansas City bands were always searching for, was that big hit that would establish them nationally.
You don't have to put that in the past tense.
No. You know, same thing happens today. You know, I mean, Samantha Fish is an extension of that tradition. And the other bands making movies and the other bands that come out of Kansas City, they want that hit song to establish them nationally. And this is the song that really established the Kirk Band. And Andy, that at the end of the summer engagement, Andy left town, and it continued selling. So it really established the band nationally.
But this idea of a Kansas City standard, what does that mean to you? I mean, it seems like this is a phenomenon that took place in a very particular kind of musical environment, that there would be a local standard.
Well, one of the things that allowed that to happen, the local standards to emerge nationally, is there was a major, Kansas City was a publishing center. You had Jenkins Music. You had the Kansas City Talking Machine Company. And there were you know, probably about a dozen music publishers here.
Publishing what? Sheet music?
Sheet music, yeah. The popularity of a song was gauged by sheet music sales in the early days before the record industry really fully developed.
That sounds very quaint, but when people were out buying a lot of sheet music, then the idea is that they were playing those songs in their own homes, or was this sales among musicians, professional musicians?
Well, both musicians and individuals buying them to play in their own home. You know, you had song pluggers in like Cat's Drugs downtown where you could go in and pick a piece of sheet music and they would play it for you.
Aw.
Or you could go into Jenkins Music and select an item and play it on their piano. They would have a piano where you could play it. And so publishing played a very important part of the development of the Kansas City style and these Kansas City standards.
Yeah, because everyone was riffing on these songs because they had the sheet music to them.
Correct, correct. And the phonograph industry comes along really strong not until the 20s. And before that, I mean, one of the most popular music stores in town was the Kansas City Talking Machine Company. And they were at 425 Delaware. And the fact that it's a talking machine rather than a phonograph in the title tells you this is still a industry that's really in its dawn of its existence, you know. And they also published sheet music, and they published cylinders, original cylinders. They were one of the major manufacturers of cylinders, along with Edison and Columbia in those
days. But then a record would sort of enshrine a version of a song, which is different from what happens with a standard being reinterpreted by every different person who comes across the sheet music.
That's correct. That's correct.
You know, you brought in some other songs. Let's hear The Letter Edged in Black, and then we'll talk about it, okay?
Sure.
I was standing by my window.
I love this song, and I've never heard it before. What is the story?
Well, it was written by Harriet Woodbury under the pseudonym of Hattie Nevada, and it was published here in Kansas City in 1897 by the Kansas City Talking Machine Company, and it became a national smash, and it sold 300,000 pieces of sheet music at 50 cents a piece, and that really kind of caught the attention of composers and really brought Kansas City to the forefront as a music publishing center and really first established Kansas City. And in those days, of course, you know, everybody relied upon the mail to communicate. If you wanted to talk, you know, wanted to communicate with someone, you'd write them a letter. It was a custom of the day when there was a death in the family that a family member would send another family member a letter edged in black notifying that someone had died. And in this case,
would that be just sort of the, like if someone's delivering bad news, they might say, I think you need to sit down or something like that.
Correct. Only they would warn him by a letter edged in black is what they called it. And this is about the author learning about the death of his mother. And it became a Southern ballad, very popular. It was recorded by Fiddlin' John Carson and a big hit with Vernon Dalhart, too. But it was also recorded by the Kansas City Talking Machine Company, although those cylinders have not survived. And it endures. It's you know, that there's something romantic about, there's a lot of songs about death and you know, Southern murder ballads and such that. This became one of the first big country hits, really.
You know, the idea of a standard to me has so much to do with performance, but the sheet music piece of it really makes me realize that we're talking about a time period where it sounds like people generally knew how to play music themselves, A, and B, did that together for fun.
Sure. If you wanted to listen to music and you didn't have a musician in the family, you would have a mechanical music device like player pianos or a roller organ or a number of those, and you would play the standards on those. So it was a very different time technically, with technology.
So one thing I think is interesting about the song you just brought in, the Letter Edged in Black, it is a really cool song. I love it. It's something that Kansas City at one time was known for. And I've never heard it. And I'm kind of going out on a limb here and going to say a lot of our listeners probably haven't heard it, don't know about it, don't know it has any relationship to Kansas City. And it seems like, I don't know, I wonder what it takes for us to remember some of these things. It feels like the song Go Into Kansas City has been passed down and we turn to that so readily. But do we have to say our name to, like, remember that it's related to us?
Well, I think it reflects that Kansas City has long been a destination in song. In 1909, the great ragtime pianist and concert pianist Blind Boone published some sheet music of Southern rag medley, Strains from the Flat Branch, which contained the refrain, "Carrie's gone to Kansas City. She's done gone, and I'm going too." And then in 1927, Jim Jackson recorded Kansas City Blues for the Vocalion label. And part one and part two, where he's talking about walking down Beale, "She's done gone to Kansas City and I'm going too." And it was such a popular song, he recorded four different takes of it. And it's considered to be one of the first million-selling blues songs. So that establishes Kansas City as a destination. And the music of that era is just riddled with references to Kansas City. Going to Kansas City has its own particular story, the song Kansas City.
Well, you brought in a version by Wilbert Harrison. Should we begin playing that now? Because it's going to take us through the break, and I want to hear some words about it on our way out.
Yeah, let's go.
So, Chuck, what should our listeners know about this version on our way to our break?
Well, this was the big hit, and it's a variation on a theme that was first recorded by Little Willie Littlefield, 1952. It was recorded as Kansas City Lovin'. And Little Willie Littlefield, it was written by Lieber and Stoller. They own the copyright to it. But Little Willie Littlefield was playing in Kansas City at the Orchid Room, which was in the back of the Lincoln Tavern at 12th and Vine.
Yeah.
And he did a long stint there with the Lucky Enoish Band and then went to California and recorded his version of Kansas City. And it was a minor hit. And then it was covered by Little Richard in 1955. Hank Ballard also did a version of it.
We might have to hear the rest of this story coming back. How does that sound to you?
Right.
Okay, Little Richard is where we're leaving off. I'm Gina Kaufman talking to Chuck Haddix about Kansas City Standards. We'll be right back. They got some crazy little women there and I'm gonna give me one. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And I'm talking with our own Chuck Haddix, host of The Fish Fry and director of the Mars Sound Archive, about the Kansas City standards that defined the Kansas City sound. We were just, as you could hear, listening to Kansas City, Here I Come, or Going to Kansas City is actually what it's called.
Which, you know, what's interesting is they changed the lyric for the Wilbert Harrison, and they kind of cleaned it up a bit when Little Willie Littlefield said he was going to Kansas City. He was going to sneak out on his woman and go to Kansas City.
Dang.
And here, of course, they're going to Kansas City with a bottle of Kansas City wine and at a crazy little women there. It really defined Kansas City's women, too, as crazy little women. And it was that was a big hit. And then, of course, later on, the Beatles would cover the version, Little Richard version, and they would add it to their set when they played here in Kansas City, one of the few times that they added a song to their set, and just because they were in Kansas City, they couldn't resist it. And it's been recorded numerous times since then with variations.
So that's the Kansas City standard with international interpretations.
Correct. Yeah, well, Kansas City has an international reputation for being a music capital, not only jazz, but also rhythm and blues and soul and country western, too.
You know, can you spell out a little more the relationship between a Kansas City standard and the Kansas City sound?
Well, standards are the Kansas City sound is really, when you're talking about jazz, it is powered by a driving rhythm section and distinguished by sections, the brass and reed section riffing against each other. That's a short melodic statement. It's very, Count Basie said, it's music you could tap your feet to. And Basie's really the culmination of the Kansas City sound, Basie and Jay McShann. Kansas City jazz style evolved very quickly from ragtime to bebop in 20 years. In 1920...
That is fast. I mean, there was a time in my life where I might not have said so, but 20 years is fast for a sound to evolve like that.
Oh, sure. You know, in 1920, you've got James Scott, who is a little piano professor, publishing Don't Jazz Me Rag on Music. 1940, you've got Charlie Parker playing bebop with the Jay McShann Band. That's a very quick evolution, and that's what really distinguished the Kansas City style from the other music centers, Chicago, New York, and New Orleans.
I want to talk about the 12th Street Rag, and, you know, you mentioned this song in conversation with our producer. One of the things I like about it is that, of course, most cities have a 12th Street, but this 12th Street means something in Kansas City. There are no lyrics, but it's there in the title.
12th Street was like Las Vegas. Las Vegas was inspired by 12th Street. Dave Dexter Jr. estimated there were as many as 20 clubs in a single block. There were taxi dance places. There were gambling joints. 12th Street was a really wild place. And this itinerant pianist, Uday Bowman, was originally from Texas, came to Kansas City, and he hooked up with his friend Raggedy Andy. And Raggedy Andy was going to open a pawn shop. And there were a lot of pawn shops downtown. So on a bet, Uday composed 12th Street Rag's 3/4 pattern after the three balls that hung in front of the pawn shops.
Whoa.
And he published it in Fort Worth, and it didn't really take off. And then Jenkins Music bought the rights to it. And it became an international bestseller and a ragtime standard, and probably the most recognizable rag to come out of Kansas City.
Well, let's give it a little listen. This is Benny Moten and his Kansas City Orchestra with the 12th Street Rag. So the rhythm here is inspired by a sign over a pawn shop?
By the three balls that hung out in front of the pawn shop. What's interesting is Jenkins Music published what they called a dotted version of this, an arrangement of 12th Street Rag. And so Benny Moten and the other Kansas City bands began performing it. This was recorded for the Victory label probably about 1927. And if memory serves... And so it becomes the bridge between the earlier ragtime tradition and what would become Kansas City swing.
Huh. Can you point out to us in what we're hearing exactly what it is that we're hearing that gets picked up by swing?
Well, you've got an orchestral expression of ragtime. And it's got that raggy, you know, that rhythm, that syncopated rhythm that ragtime's so distinguished with.
Uh-huh, totally.
But it's also got the jazz, the hot breaks, soloists and the sections playing against each other, and all those kind of distinguishing characteristics of Kansas City jazz are there. It's still the kernel, but you can hear it.
Okay, well, we've got another one coming up. This one also with Benny Moten and his Kansas City Orchestra. This one's Moten Swing. What's the story on this one?
This one was recorded in December of 1932. And this is only 5 years after 12th Street, they recorded 12th Street Rag, but musically it's world apart. It's really an early swing. It anticipates the swing, foreshadows the swing movement that would come along in 3 years. And Moten Swing was written by Count Basie and Eddie Durham. The band was on a tour to the East Coast, and they stopped at the Pearl Theater, and Sam Stifel, the owner, was complaining because they didn't have any new material. So Basie and Durham went to the basement, and they cooked up Moten Swing, and it's based upon the chord changes of the popular song You're Driving Me Crazy. And so when the Bands in the Know perform this, they always interpolate the two.
Was this Bands in the Know here in Kansas City?
Here in Kansas City, or even Illinois Jacquet, when he played at Lincoln Center, he performed it that way, and also Johnny Otis Band. And Count and Joe Turner recorded it too, where it's you, you're driving me crazy. What did I do? What did I do? And then they breaks out into Motown Swing for the last half of the song. And the interesting thing is they went to the studio in Camdenton, and they had to hitch a ride there. Their bus had been seized. They were broke. They were desperate. And they went to a pool hall and all ate out of this stew. And Eddie Bearfield, there's rabbits. They were told it was rabbit stew, but Eddie Bearfield thought they were eating a cat because there was no rabbits there where they were at. He theorized they were eating a cat. And he used to kid Count Basie about eating a cat. And that hunger that they had really shines through in this very edgy arrangement of Motown Swing.
Well, let's give it a listen. This sounds hungry to you?
Yeah. The Eastern bands have been using riffs in their arrangements, but Kansas City uses them more pronounced. And you can hear the interplay of the sections and Basie's piano intro, and then it's peppered by soloists. Listen. It's a very sharp arrangement, much sharper than anything. It marked a real departure from in the Kansas City style. It really kind of defined what would become the Kansas City style.
So the new Kansas City style.
The new style, Kansas City style. And this is 3 years before Benny Goodman became the king of swing.
So the idea of, maybe I'm misunderstanding the idea of a Kansas City standard. To me, a standard is something that just everyone within some community knows and plays and riffs on. And is that what this was? I mean, did other people in Kansas City, like, did the national performers kind of discover it passing through town? What's
sure? Well, it was recorded for the Bluebird label, which was a subsidiary of Victor. And at that time, the Bluebirds were 33 cents. Normal records were a dollar. So it was distributed nationally. And also the Motown band was playing major venues on the East Coast, too. I mean, the Savoy Ballroom.
So they took the standards that people played around here and introduced them in their travels?
Well, when you're talking about standards, you're talking about, okay, Until the Real Thing Comes Along was a popular song that Kansas City artists took on and made their own. And in a way, this is the same thing. It's based upon the changes of You're Driving Me Crazy, but it's an original composition. It's a swing version of that. And ironically, they don't state the melody until the out chorus on this one.
Huh.
But this sold nationally and sold very well. And it's a song that's still played today.
So what were some of the different trajectories that these songs might take? I mean, some of them did kind of stay local, right?
Well, they're songs that did remain local, but as the groups broke out nationally, they became national songs. I mean, when, for example, Count Basie and Buster Smith and Eddie Durham wrote 1 O'Clock Jump when they were members of the Basie Band, but it wasn't recorded until till the Basie Band recorded it in 1937, and that was the big hit that established the band nationally. So it was a local song originally, but because of recordings, recording for the Decca label, it became a national hit. And Kansas City had a tendency, for example, the McKinney Cotton Pickers had a song called I Want a Little Girl. And they sing it very politely. When Joe Turner sings it, he talks about, I don't care if she don't wear pantyhose. He kind of sexes it up a little bit. And it became a Kansas City standard as a result, the Kansas City version.
Well, so I've talked to you before about one of my Kansas City favorites, Julia Lee, and this is a conversation we had ages ago, but she had one big hit that you'll find on all kinds of old-timey jazz compilations, but otherwise, her other songs, she was mostly a local treasure, if I understand it right, who didn't really export her sound all that much.
Well, she lived here locally, but she recorded for the Capitol label. Dave Dexter recorded her for the Capitol label. And her songs were, she sang risque songs her mother taught her not to sing.
Yeah, with a lot of double entendre.
Double entendre, right. And so she didn't receive any airplay on the radio, but she received a lot of jukebox play. And her song, Snatch and Grab It, sold over 500,000 copies nationally just due to the strength of play on jukeboxes.
And then the song that I was going to play for people, just it seems like one of the best known, is Come On Over to My House, Baby. That's the one that seems to have lasted in sort of a mainstream jazz appreciation kind of way.
Sure. She originally recorded this with the George E. Lee Band in 1929. And then after World War II, World War II was winding down, Dave Dexter Jr. was producing an album of Kansas City jazz for Capitol Records. And he was going to feature Julia Lee, and Jay McShann was just fresh out of the service, and he came back and participated in the session. And it's Jay on piano and Julia Lee on vocals. And this is pretty typical of the kind of, quote, risque stuff that she would record and perform.
But so when we talk about jukeboxes, it seems interesting to me that something like a jukebox at one time determined whether a song ever not only reached national ears at the time when it was performed, but also remains in our memory as a culture.
Sure. Well, jukeboxes were responsible for breaking songs, particularly for African-American artists that didn't necessarily receive any airplay because radio was pretty white in those days. When Jay McShann recorded Confessing the Blues, he was out on tour, and it began to sell tremendously because of jukebox play. It wasn't receiving any airplay, but people heard it on the jukebox and bought the record.
And so this is another era we've moved into also. I mean, is this, you know, we've talked about jukeboxes, sheet music, local radio stations that played recordings by local musicians and cities that heard the, you know, we haven't talked actually that much about local cities hearing their own sounds rather than a national sound on the radio.
Well, you know, beginning with the Coon Sanders original Nighthawk Orchestra that broadcast live from the Muehlbach Hotel, they were picked up nationally because they had a clear channel. Kansas City radio stations regularly broadcast bands in the clubs. For example, W9XBY broadcast from the Reno Club, and everybody—that's how John Hammond heard Count Basie. They also broadcast from Lucille's Paradise when Charlie Parker was there. So Charlie Parker was being heard all over the Midwest because of these broadcasts. And, you know,
this is obvious, but in the absence of something like music streaming, I mean, this is how you heard music, and it was local music you were hearing.
Yeah, it's the golden web that brought us all together. And also, you know, Kansas City really, because of these broadcasts, that really reinforced Kansas City's reputation as a music town and a jazz town.
What do you mean by that? How did that?
Well, with the Coon Sanders Band, you could pick their broadcasts up. They were on at 11:30 till 1. You'd pick them up from Maine to Hawaii. And the radio was like the internet of its day. It was a new thing. Everybody wanted to get a radio. And so, you know, those broadcasts really established Kansas City as a beacon of jazz. And then following their lead, Benny Moten begins broadcasting on WHB. And that can be picked up across the Midwest. And so people in rural towns could hear these broadcasts that were done from clubs and, you know, the Vine Street Varieties, which was a local, very popular local radio review, was also broadcast by WHB on Saturday afternoons, and people all over the Midwest could hear that. So that's the way the radio also helped get the word out.
So with it being such a different world today technologically, do we still have our own little insidery things here in Kansas City, or are those days kind of over?
Oh, I think we do. You know, Kansas City is still remains a music town. You can go out and hear music any night of the week. You know, radio programs like The Fish Fry, and you know, I'm always getting new releases. For example, you know, Samantha Fish released two CDs that charted on the at the top of the charts this last
year. A very young blues performer.
Yeah, a very young blues performer. Making Movies gets a nod at the Latin Grammys. There's so many musicians that are breaking out of Kansas City, and they're following the same path that Benny Moten and Andy Kirk took, where they went to New York because that was the music capital at the time. And so we still have these artists that are really playing Kansas City music and making their mark in the world.
What do you think, you know, We've talked so much about the songs themselves, but take me back to the musical environment where, you know, if someone, the average person in Kansas City, not the musician, but the person who might just head out to the club one night, what did these Kansas City standards mean to them?
Well, you know, there were, Kansas City has always had such a rich musical history. And, well, you know, civic pride is a lot like the Royals. This is our song. This came from us. You know, all boats rise with the tide. And it does a lot for civic pride.
Chuck Haddix of KCUR's Fish Fry and the Mars Sound Archive, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Let's do this again.
Yeah, I loved it. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, a visit with the author of a new guide to the breweries, distilleries, and vineyards of Kansas and Missouri. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now Pete Doolin is here. He's the author of a few books now on local food and drink, but mostly drink. He's brought in his new book, Expedition of Thirst, exploring breweries, wineries, and distilleries across the heart of Kansas and Missouri. If you've visited a local brewery, distillery, or vineyard that you found fascinating, was it the history, the agriculture, the detour, the stories that intrigued you? Call 816-235-2888 to chime in. Hi, Pete.
Good morning.
So what inspired you to write this book other than the prospect of some really fun research?
It was fun research. I love to travel, and I think it's a great way to explore and see what's out there. And with this project, it was published by the University Press of Kansas, based in Lawrence, and they actually contacted me about taking on this book project based on the prior books that I had published, and it sounded right up my alley to hit the road and explore the eastern half of Kansas and the western half of Missouri.
You wouldn't want to schedule your return trip on the same day.
No. Yeah, I spread this this travel and research out over basically spring through fall of last year. Took a lot of long weekend road trips and some day trips as well.
So you focused on craft beverages, and you write a little bit about how that word may be losing some currency just due to pretty extreme overuse, along with words like artisan. What does the word craft actually mean? Instead of just something kind of cool.
You know, I think like in brewing, it has a, the Brewing Association, you know, has its own terminology as far as defining craft. I think when you, I don't know that there's a standard term or definition that's applied to distilling or winemaking, but often I think in terms of making something, usually it's small production. There's, you know, some level of skill and knowledge that's applied to it, a certain set of standards. But at the same time, I don't know that there's a universally agreed upon standard. So it's one of those terms that is often applied to many things, but you don't necessarily know exactly what it is. And yeah, again, like kind of going back to craft beer, beer that's small production. And so like the Brewing Association has kind of different levels of like the scale of the business and the production, as opposed to like the major macro beer producers. So that's kind of one like very loose, you know, definition of craft.
There are a lot of places in town that have made a pretty big effort to sort of focus on and make available these kinds of drinks in their places of business without having to leave town. What would you say that a person gains by going to visit the places where their beer or spirits or wine are made?
So like, are you referring to like tap rooms, for example?
Yeah. Why? Yeah. Or just, you know, there are a lot of, beer places that focus on local. You can get local wines, local-ish wines.
Sure.
At a lot of restaurants.
I think there's been a surge of interest in exploring what's made locally, whether it's beer, wine, or spirits. And I think that falls in line with just the larger support local movement, whether it's local restaurants, local food products, a local retail store. And
but why go to the place where it's made? Why visit, why visit the vineyard?
Part of it, I think, is being able to meet the people that make the product, whether it's the brewer, the winemaker, the distiller, or the owner of the business. You get a sense of place, of like where it's from. You get to learn the story behind that alcohol. And I think that's really important for a lot of people, because there's only so much information you can convey through a label on a bottle or can, or going to a website. But traveling to the place where it's made, you get to talk to the person that created it, and they'll tell more of the backstory, not only about the brewery or winery or distillery, but what goes into the product, and even their personal story. A lot of these places that I write about, they're small family-owned businesses, or they're entrepreneurs. And so they kind of have their own journey of how they started to how they established the business and why they do what they do.
I liked the story behind the Union Horse Distilling Company in Lenexa.
Mm-hmm.
You write that they take a – so we'll get to the story, but you write that they take a grain-to-bottle approach. What does that mean?
Well, they really kind of focus on every aspect of the process. And, with spirits, it starts with the grains that you're working with. And they're just hyper-focused on every aspect, from the grain, the milling, the actual distilling process, down to bottling by hand and applying those labels by hand and numbering the bottles.
And you write about that they use Missouri corn, Kansas wheat, and rye from the upper Midwest.
Yeah. So they, what goes into the product is very important to get, the quality results that you want at the end. And so they're just very particular about sourcing the grains that they use. And, they take care to source locally and work with the farmers and vendors to get that grain that has specific qualities that produce the attributes and the spirit.
Tell me about the people who run this place. It was started by siblings, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, it's Patrick, Damien, and I can't remember the other siblings, but they were looking to start a business together as a family and create something that they could build and keep within the family and be able to pass on to other generations.
And that's not just, a lot of people focus on investing in order to pass something on financially to future generations, which this is a form of that. But it seems like it's also about having a place for the family to be over generations, which is a little different. And it seems like a lot of the stories in this book are about that, are kind of about having a place to be.
Absolutely. And it's
like not just the drinks themselves, but the setting where they're produced becomes.
Very much so. I think I found this, not only in major cities, but also in smaller communities where you have these entrepreneurs that have established a business, and you have to have a passion for doing it and certainly the resources. But I think just as important is, again, that sense of place and like creating something that's part of the community. And if you have a tasting room at a winery or a tap room at a distillery or brewery, it's a place for people to gather, your friends, your neighbors, your family, as well as that hospitality aspect of having people travel, on the road and stop in and try something that's available there that is not necessarily available everywhere. And so I think that sense of place and building something as a business is important. It's also creating jobs, and it's contributing to the community and the local economy as well. And I think that's really vital no matter where you're located.
There are also a lot of second careers in this book, both chronologically, as in people leaving, say, finance, and then also just simultaneous second careers, like people who are juggling both their vineyard or brewery job with some other whole job, like the guy who's a FedEx driver who runs the Kansas City Wine Company with his wife, and they have a pumpkin patch.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's, one, a testament to the Midwestern work ethic and you know, just having to work really hard and hustle. And these businesses, they're not inexpensive businesses to launch. There's a lot of capital involved, and it's, you know, it's a lot of time investment as well. While there's certainly the demand out there for locally made beer, wine, and spirits, there's a high barrier to entry in terms of the money that you're going to spend for the equipment to get it established.
And it seems from your book like a pretty saturated market. There are tons of places. I was surprised. And you're not even focusing. You're focusing strictly on what? Western Missouri and Eastern Kansas.
Right, right. So, which is still a fairly sizable territory, you know, on a regional level. But like within that territory, there's roughly about 150 businesses covered in that book. The vast majority of them are relatively young. I mean, you have some older established breweries and wineries, but a lot of them are really newer. And again, like the people that have established them, like they have that passion and drive to want to create something themselves. And that, I think it's part of not only having the work ethic to pull two jobs and two careers, you know, like the Aaron Ogilvie at Double Shift. I mean, literally, he names the brewery after the fact that he works as a firefighter and as a brewery owner. He works two jobs. That's pretty common in the startup brewery world. With wineries, it's for a lot of wineries. There are people that have the financial resources to do it because that's kind of a different scale of operation. You can't just open a winery overnight. You've got to acquire the land. You've got to plant the vines. Those vines take 3 to 5 years before they start yielding fruit that's
usable.
Yeah,
there's one story I remember where one person had started a winery and his daughter was really interested in a particular grape and he wanted to like cultivate that grape or something, and it's been 2 years and there's still, you know, they still don't have that grape.
Yeah, yeah. It's, I mean, there's a lot of things that can happen. You know, it's not necessarily a guarantee that just because you plant in the ground, it's going to grow and produce something. You're subject, it's an agricultural crop. Grapevines are just like corn or wheat or soybeans. And so it's subject to weather, to pass, you know, a lot of different factors. And so sometimes there's a learning curve there, and it can be very expensive and challenging as well.
We've been talking about a lot of the newer places and the entrepreneurial aspect of this, but there are also places with a lot of history. Will you tell me about one of your favorite places with a real history to it?
Let's see. I think there's a Prairie Fire Winery, which is in Paxico, Kansas. It's between Lawrence and Topeka. And they have that passion and that knowledge. It's Bob DeRusso is the co-owner and his wife. And the winery is located in the Flint Hills, and it really draws on the landscape. Bob has invested a lot of time in education, in learning about winemaking and viticulture, first of all. But he's also really immersed himself into the history of the landscape and the terroir as much as...
Terroir, explain
yes.
that.
So terroir kind of refers to not only the physical land, but like the climate, the weather patterns, you know, how the wind flows and how the sun falls, and like all these environmental factors that can affect the grapes that you're growing. And it can vary a lot just by a few miles. And so like he selected land that has this great sun exposure. The wind flows in a certain direction that helps cool the grapes during the summer. It has a good slope where water drains away from the vine, so the feet or the roots of the vines don't get too wet. And so there's all these factors that are involved. And Bob is, you know, one of many winemakers that not just has to know about making wine, but understand all these other factors, the diseases and the pests and the geography and the lay of the land. And there's, you know, he's very knowledgeable about the rich history of winemaking in Kansas as well, which dates back to pre-Prohibition.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that history, because just the amount of history to this, this region is not historically known for winemaking above and beyond all else, but that there is a long history is sort of, yeah, like maybe not something a lot of people realize.
Yeah, yeah. It dates back to like the early 1800s. It started to hit its peak around the mid 1800s. As immigrants from Germany and Western Europe came over and started migrating from the Eastern U.S. and St. Louis over to Missouri and Kansas. And you started with the Germans in particular, which were one of the largest immigrant groups to settle in this area. They brought with them knowledge of winemaking and capital resources to establish vineyards.
Did they bring like seeds or anything? It's the idea that you're trying to transplant agriculture from one continent to another seems full of pitfalls.
Well, I don't know that they necessarily brought grapevines over. The area was actually blessed with a lot of native grapes. You don't have.
So they learned to work with those.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're, you know, I think part of the appeal of settling in the area for a lot of the people were, you know, along the riverbanks and throughout these rich river valleys, you had a wide variety of native grapes that were growing. We're also blessed with really good soil for those grapes to naturally grow as well as be cultivated. The whole throughout the Midwest, it's very mineral-rich soil that dates all the way back to the glacial ages. And so those immigrant winemakers were able to establish these pretty prominent vineyards. There's one county, Doniphan County. It's in the northeast corner of Kansas, right off of the Missouri River, where there were some pretty prominent German winemakers, a family of a couple of brothers and a son that started several wineries that were very prominent and produced some very superior quality wines. And they were just like one small sample of many winemakers throughout the state that were producing these large volumes of grapes and also producing wine that rose from basically the 1850s up to like the 1890s. And then at the same time, you kind of had this opposing force of temperance where people were against the consumption, sale, and manufacture of alcohol. And that was also
kind of
rising.
Which was illegal also, right?
Well, at a certain point, yeah. It became illegal. And Kansas was one of the first states. It actually was the first state that enacted state prohibition in 1880. It went into effect in 1881. And it was illegal to sell and manufacture alcohol.
What's the detail that you think about a lot from your trips that didn't necessarily make it into the entry in the book? Because each entry is a few paragraphs long, and I know each trip had to be full of beautiful moments that couldn't make the cut.
Well, I think that's exactly it. Is you know, part of the adventure of travel is seeing those sights, not only the destination, but along the way from point to point. And so like if you take a weekend winery tour or brewery tour, it's seeing the landscape and then it's meeting the people and those spontaneous stories as well.
Quickly on the way out, tell us about just one more place fairly close to Kansas City.
I would say Walnut River Brewing is an interesting place in El Dorado, Kansas, that has a fun place to visit. at one point there was a brothel that operated in the building. So it has, again, has that sense of history and rich story there to explore, as well as great beer in the tap room.
Well, we've got to jog out of here, but Pete Doolin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pete's book is Expedition of Thirst, Exploring Breweries, Wineries, and Distilleries Across the Heart of Kansas and Missouri. It's from the University Press of Kansas. And that's it for today's show, but you've got a great trip on your hands if you pick up this book. You can listen back to both of this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, Kansas City's connection to the movie The Post and what's new in thinking on how to best serve kids with special needs in the public education system. That's tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with a lot of help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.